computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and we are speaking to Jerry Frazier, PhD, who has written an article at Kennedy's and King Now, The Missile Crisis, Writing on the Wall. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Good. I usually get a note from Jim when something, you know, important comes along, and he says, look, you should have this guy on, you should have this guest on. And, of course, anybody tuning into Black Op Radio will be interested in the Cuban Missile Crisis, the missile crisis itself, President Kennedy, things of that. So I guess my first question for you would be, what got your interest in this to end up writing about it?
Well, of course, being someone who follows Kennedy stories and news and history, I've always been interested in the missile crisis. But I was listening to Jeffrey Sachs. As of late, people think he may have had different politics 10 years ago or so, but whether he's changed or not, I really like where he is today. And so he was talking about this book, and he was saying, you got to read the book. It's the best book written on the subject, and you just can't put it down. And I said, well, that's a pretty good endorsement. So I got the book, and he was right. You can't put it down. I hate to use a cliche, but it's a page turner. It's written like a novel. And, you know, these different people that you're familiar with historically project the personality, and you get little insights into people. And so all in all, it's a great book. It's about 450 pages, but it goes fast.
And something in there, what was the catalyst that really piqued you to go further?
Well, there were a number of things that jumped out. One of the things, I know that John Newman has said that the intelligence surrounding the installation of the missile sites in Cuba was, the knowledge of that was held back to kind of entrap Kennedy so that when he found out, he'd have to use some aggressive military action. But I never saw sources on it or anything. And so I was reading, and in one part in the book, he talks about this New York Senator, John Keating, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, who had been going around very overtly saying that Khrushchev had installed offensive missiles in Cuba, and he's saying this September 1st, all the way on through. And Kennedy thought that he's a Republican, he's just making a lot of noise because of the election coming up. I took a little bit of time to investigate that myself, and there are some of these kind of academic articles in I don't know how you pronounce it, JSTOR. Anyway, so I read through all those regarding this Keating, and sure enough, he had this knowledge, and people were pressing him for his source. Well, what's the source? And he just wouldn't budge. Even Ted Kennedy years later was asking him about it. And the funny thing was, is during during the first XCOM meeting, and for your listeners, XCOM is Executive Committee of the National Security Council that was a team of 15 to 20 Kennedy advisors that he brought together to figure out how to solve the problem, how to deal with the problem. And on the very first day, these people were aware of it, and they were asking who was his source. And they whoever handles the tape, it was the XCOM conversations were taped, secretly taped. Whoever presides over those deleted the name of the person that was Keating's source. So it's just very mysterious. The closest to identifying anybody was that he did say the source is an intelligence person operating in the Department of Defense. So there you have it. So that I think John Newman, I'm not sure how he pieces it together. I haven't read anything by him with regard to that. But apparently wherever he's getting his information is probably correct. And that's one hell of a thing. The offensive weapons on the island of Cuba, directed towards the United States, and people in intelligence are holding this information back to probably entrap Kennedy so that he'd be up against the wall and have to act a little bit more, recklessly, really. So that was one thing. There were other little things like I would guess followers of your program and readers of the site won't be happy to hear that Robert Kennedy really comes across as a little bit on the Sherwin says that the people who were attending these meetings thought of him as arrogant. He would be sitting back in a chair with chewing gum with his foot up on the table and, giving his thoughts. And I don't know if it was in jest or not, but he would say to some people, I'm going to tell my brother. And then there was one other point during the 13 days in which they struggled to come up with an approach. He said, oh, I'm just so tired of this. I'm worried about my kids. And maybe we should just go in there and get it over with. So that was kind of disappointing. Although he played a very key role in terms of being JFK's, I don't know what the correct diplomat or something to a Russian official, so a back channel diplomat. So he was playing that role.
I don't know if it's an old word, but brain trust, or somebody that you you look for that kind of help. Yeah. I just hate to interrupt because I know I'm got your article in front of me, but I don't know. Did we mention the name of the book, Gambling with Armageddon, by Martin Sherwin, right? That's what you were talking about that inspired you, right?
And Jim then told me that he also wrote, now I hope I don't get this wrong because I didn't read it, but American Prometheus, having to do with Oppenheimer. That book was the basis of the film. Is it Oppenheimer?
Oppenheimer, yeah, it's his last name.
Oppenheimer. So he's a very, very good writer, and that's one of his books. But then I understand he has since died. The book is relatively recent, so I guess in the last year or so he died. Because I've seen recently interviews with Jeffrey Sachs and him on YouTube. And I suspect it didn't seem like it was that long ago, but he's no longer with us. Anyway, so the book. The one other thing that comes as a little bit of a surprise is that there's a bunch of surprises, but another one that is both McNamara and Robert Kennedy, of course, are super loyal to JFK. But each of them flip-flops throughout the process from saying, yes, I think maybe a blockade or quarantine is an effective way, first step, to kind of get into communication with Khrushchev. But then on other times, they would be hawkish and saying, I think, that was the problem, is that the longer this went on, the more likely it would require military intervention, because Kennedy kept delaying everything and pushing the hawks off, saying, look, well, we should really try this first, or we now need to take another step and see if we can get some communication with Khrushchev. And so they waited a little bit longer, and they were just beside themselves. There was one time where the admiral, of the head of the Navy, chief of the Navy, can't remember his name right now, but anyway, he almost came to blows with McNamara, with all 10 other admirals standing around watching this, that he became so heated that because what McNamara told him, he said, look, even if the Russians or the Soviets attack us with some kind of weapon, you are not to fire back using nuclear weapons or fire back at all until the president says you can. Well, they just went, they were apoplectic. You know, they're saying, absolutely no way. That's crossing a bright red line. So there's all kind of things going on that, it's a great drama. And he presents it, very, very nicely. I had no problems, finishing the book, or I just sailed right through it because it was, the outcome. But at the same time, you really don't know how it all transpired. So great book.
Yeah. Right, and inspired you to do more research and then even write about this, right? Yeah. To write about the goings-on in Cuba. And I think people who may have seen 13 Days or that would have the same kind of interest.
Yes.
Yeah, you've got my interest. I'm going to have to find that interview. I mean, I just love anything Jeffrey Sachs has to say. I'm just find him so intelligent.
On YouTube, just search for Jeffrey Sachs interview of Martin Sherwin. And there's actually more than one. So he must have done it several times. Yeah, easy to find. Yeah, no, it has stimulated me. There's different things that he talks about in the book that got me thinking about how to think about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassination of Kennedy. That's the payoff for people who are very focused on the assassination, is that you can see how all of this, I said in my article, I said that Sherwin presents us with a through line from Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala and Castro in Cuba and the Bay of Pigs and then the missile crisis. And he talks about, he doesn't explicitly talk about the assassination. He'll just drop little hints, like, for instance, at the end when it was resolved, he said something like, and so people in Washington D.C. really took a big breath of relief, but the Pentagon was very unhappy. So hint, hint, he has a lot of those little things. And he brings the reader into the regime change situation in Iran and Guatemala. I think you could also, if you wanted to string this out, I think you could also, add in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, because it's a very similar dynamics, where there's a progressive leader wanting to move in a direction that is harmful to business interests. The business interests put pressure on security people and presidents or prime ministers, and they launch a covert operation, sometimes involving assassination, sometimes not. That same dynamic with those same ingredients is straight on through to Kennedy's assassination. Because when there's a point at which the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs, where a bunch of business leaders who have investments in companies and so on in Cuba, they get together and they tell Dulles, says, get Eisenhower in here. We've got to get off the dime on this. And so you can see, it's interesting because you can see a way of looking at the assassination by virtue of looking at how these other regime change operations unfolded and assassinations unfolded. And you can start to understand the dynamic in which I think is, whether it's Great Britain or Belgium or the U.S., we're all capitalist countries. Our constitution, our republic is organized around entrepreneurial activity, investment activity, that's the priority. The founders drew up a constitution that would enable government people to expedite or enhance or augment economic activity. And when you get in front of that train, you're really asking for trouble. And so it's interesting to watch how the people who pop up and really put pressure on the politicians are corporate people. Another example would be Allende in Chile. And I think this was 73. And Anaconda, copper putting pressure on Kissinger. So you can see a dynamic happening, which is another way of adding justification to what you and Jim and all the political researchers do. It just reinforces it from a structural point of view. I think of it this way. I think that what you do and what Jim does and all the authors and investigators that you have on your show, it seems like a courtroom drama. You know, there's evidence that's prevented. A lot of times you'll say it's all fact-based, and an argument or whodunit, you know, it emerges out of there. And so you begin to explain or indict various people who were involved in the assassination. Whereas I've never done that kind of research, but I look at it more in terms of what do major corporations want? Is the government enabling that to happen? When does something happen that the powerful corporate owners will then push various buttons and ask for military intervention? Just as we all know in Guatemala, you know, it was United Fruit, which Dulles and his brother were on, that kind of thing. So you can see that cabal in each of those situations.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, right, is a real intelligent conversation about how the world works. And when people read the Warren Commission, they say, oh, everything was blamed on one man, it was Lee Oswald, and we've looked into it and go back to sleep. That's where, you know, people with this interest of looking into history more say, well, I just can't subscribe to that. I've got to learn more about it. And then you get into books like this where they're revealing the backroom dialogue and agreements and meetings. Where I remember one of them where Kennedy kind of walks out, you know, the Joint Chiefs, and he goes, yeah, "We call ourselves the human race. Like, right, these guys, yeah, want to bomb everything or do." And another anecdote I have is that if people don't know too much about the case, they say, "Well, you know, who killed Kennedy?" And I said, "Well, his enemies did." And they got together, and do you want to investigate a list of his enemies and who would have reason to want him removed? And then if people want to go further, but that's how I treat it. Sometimes people ask me, what's your interest? And just if you haven't even seen the movie JFK, then it's got to be very, very light. But, you know,
that's a very nice way of framing it, because that's exactly what it is. And then the next question will be, well, who were his enemies? Why were they his enemies? Here's another surprise that relates to all of this, was the role that Eisenhower played. Eisenhower comes across as a super, super hawk. It's unbelievable. We know that he gave the green light for the Lumumba assassination. And he was involved in, you know, the two regime change operations during his presidency. But he hated Kennedy. He said when he got elected, he stands for everything. He stands for everything that I stand for. I'm not going to turn everything over to this little genius. This young genius, something like that, you know. And so what he does, and it's very explicit. Sherwin doesn't pull punches on this. He says that the Bay of Pigs operation was a way to entrap Kennedy also, and that he was the one behind it. You know, I mean, he had a cabal. He had a bunch of people involved and ready to go, but he helped organize the plan, even though the plan. Another thing that was in the book that I don't know if this is, you know, news or not. I don't know. Maybe it depends on how old the book is. But a declassification of CIA planning and reports and so on reveals that they clearly said or clearly believed that the Bay of Pigs would fail unless there was U.S. military intervention to help it along. Yeah, I think we all knew that. But according to this one person, he says in all his reading of declassified CIA documents, that was the one that was the most shocking. But anyway, so Eisenhower is besides himself trying to figure out ways to get rid of Castro and his government before Kennedy's elected, after he's elected but not president, and when he's president. He plays a major role in all of that. And that's, but you never hear that name come up among political assassination researchers. And I'm thinking, well, I think more attention needs to be paid to that, given what this book comes up with. So during one of the XCOM meetings, someone who was also McCone, who's the head of the CIA at the time, he says, well, I better get in contact with the general. The general, of course, is always 5-star General Eisenhower, and to get his input. And Kennedy is listening to all this. And so Eisenhower gets on the line and he says, well, I agree with the Joint Chiefs. It's we got to go right in there now. We shouldn't waste any time. You know, the future of the freedom of our country and other countries is now hanging by a thread. Whatever, something like that. Kennedy doesn't say a word. Sherwin says, well, he didn't say a word because he thought Eisenhower was out of touch with the world. I thought that was pretty good. He had a lot of disdain for the generals. I'll say that. And it comes out they hate each other.
Yeah, I was told that that Eisenhower in his last year or so, he had a couple of heart attacks.
Yeah, that's right.
And that he might have been more of a lame duck there. And I often wonder if other people were pulling the strings, much like we saw Biden, right. Out there making speeches. But really, you wonder if he really knew what's going on.
Yeah, well, that's a question. Unless they manipulate him easily and he gives them the green light. He's anti-communist. He's as much an anti-communist hawk, I would say, as someone like LeMay. And then they hold that over Kennedy. They will say, well, a 5-star general who put together D-Day and, landing on Normandy, and now we're turning this military problem over to Lieutenant Kennedy. Are you kidding me? That's how they would, And this ties in with what Daniel Ellsberg also reported when, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, he says that the people in the Pentagon were just fuming. It said the atmosphere, it says it felt like they were preparing for a coup. Not that I'm saying that, but it almost felt like that. He says the situation was poisonous. So, I just wouldn't doubt it if Eisenhower had a role to play. But this failure of Kennedy to take out Castro and the Cuban government just antagonized the military so much. It's everywhere. They kept wanting this. They wanted to go on. Even when, and this is the they waited 13 days before it was resolved. Even on, it was day 12, I think, that there was a reconnaissance aircraft that, let me back up, on day 11, LeMay gave or allowed one of his subordinates to raise the DEFCON level from 3 to 2. And that created all kinds of upgrades of military readiness. And so a U-2 reconnaissance aircraft flew in again closely to take a look and got shot down. And the American pilot died. And they said, okay, Kennedy, come on, get off the pot. We got to get in there. And Kennedy said, no, we have to wait until we, you know, play out the quarantine thing. So he just dug his heels in, and they couldn't take it. They just hated him. So I think that's where people might have been deciding ways. How can we get rid of Kennedy? I suspect they know. He's had this back channel to Khrushchev since he's been in office, or since, I guess, Vienna in the first year. Now, I don't know if they're eavesdropping on that, likely, but he's asking for help from Khrushchev to ways of dealing with his own generals. He's buddying up to Khrushchev, and his enemies are his generals. That's just amazing. So, I don't know. So it's an interesting story.
Well, it amazed me that, I think, was it the 7th Fleet, you know, was kind of practicing doing maneuvers right off near the island there, so that they were at the ready. So if there was going to be, aircraft carriers and destroyers and things needed, they were there.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, they were. Well, I think everybody knows a story about that one. One guy on a Russian submarine, there were three people, and the Americans were dropping depth charges, not as a way to, you know, harm the submarine, but to kind of know where it is and
to force them to surface.
Yes, something like that. But the people on the submarine, that they had lost communication with Moscow, and someone gave the order to fire the missiles, and this one Russian commander just refused to do it. And as it turned out, because they didn't know whether the war had begun or not, we're out of touch, and so these depth charges are, you know, going to blow us up, we've got to fire our missiles. You know, and then there was one other instance like this, too, that had to do with the raising of the DEFCON status from 3 to 2, where someone in Okinawa got the codes mixed up and felt that he was under orders to launch the missiles. And this one captain who was 30 yards away or something in this, you know, missile site, had to get two armed airmen to go over to that lieutenant and say, you know, we're going to kill you if you try and do this. I mean, it's just incredible. And then you have William Harvey. William Harvey is I forgot the exact nature of it, but he's orchestrating military activity on the island. And Kennedy was so upset about it. You never hear about this. He was so upset, he immediately sent him off to Rome, get him out of the area. It's amazing. It's just amazing that.
Do you want to elaborate on that? Because Harvey's quite an interesting character when you think of JFK's enemies.
Yeah, no, I wish I could remember. He's in the CIA, and he's part of an assassination group or something. But anyway, I can't remember exactly what he did, but he orchestrated some kind of sabotage of whether it was some factories or the harbor or something. And blew some stuff up under his direction. You know, he's getting people, anti-Castro Cubans, to do this. Well, President Kennedy just was furious, and so immediately got him out of there and immediately sent him off to Rome. Another reason why Harvey hated Kennedy.
Now, you talked about Eisenhower and then the 13 days in your article. The idea that it would be Armageddon, and what Kennedy was recognizing, that once we fire a missile, they might fire their missiles, we have to fire all of ours, and what's the retaliation going to be?
Yeah.
Total nuclear war.
Yeah. Well, this is this is the first, I would say the first half of the book deals a lot with that sort of thing, in that, first of all, they're trying to find out what type missile, intercontinental ballistic missile, tactical missile, whatever, tactical explosive, all different ranges, you know, some, you know, 500 miles, 2,500 miles. So they hadn't quite nailed down a lot of that. And they didn't know either if they were armed. And the irony is that the Cubans and the Soviets were under orders from Moscow that if the U.S. attacks, fire the nuclear missiles. So what that means is, in practicality, is on day one, there were no, they had, oh, I think it was something like, oh, you know, 60 ICBMs in place, weren't armed yet. So U.S. intelligence doesn't understand this. They don't understand what weapons exactly and how many. They were still trying to get this kind of information. The interesting thing to me is, day one, Kennedy himself says, we got to get the missiles out of there. That's a quote. We've got to get them out of there. And it's not an order. He's just kind of thinking out loud. The savior of the whole thing was Adlai Stevenson. He immediately on day one said, I think there's a diplomatic solution. Well, that perked up Kennedy's ear. And on day two, Kennedy now was on board for a diplomatic solution. And the whole idea of a blockade / quarantine is also Stevenson. And so Kennedy said, well, you know, yeah, I think that's, we need to do that first. But there's so many questions. What ships? What's the quarantine line going to be? What do you do if someone does X? You know, all these kinds of things, which in a way was good because Kennedy always used that. He says, for example, well, he would ask some of the military people, well, what would happen if Khrushchev did something in Berlin? He was worried about Berlin. Suppose they put pressure on people in Berlin and they hold people hostage or they control certain parts of the city. What are you going to do then? Are you going to then surrender? Are you going to bomb? What are you going to do? And in that situation where McNamara went down and told the chief admiral that you can't do anything without Kennedy's permission. He says, for example, I mean, you guys aren't prepared. For example, if you're going to hail one of the Soviet ships, what language are you going to use? So the admiral says, how the hell do I know? it's almost comical. It's Three Stooges are the people running around, you know, with police chasing each other.
Yeah, Keystone Cops.
Keystone Cops. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. But it's those kind of questions, you see, that Kennedy was very good at, and he would just slow down the military or give them pause or ask them questions. So in the end, here's the reality. And this people should know because you often, in fact, I was reading a book, autobiography of Christopher Hitchens today, and he, you know, he's very glib. He's, you know, 14, 15 years old when all this happened, and he says, oh, I wasn't happy. I didn't feel anything positive towards Kennedy. I mean, he started the whole thing. This business of him starting the whole thing is erroneous. I would say the person who really started the whole thing is Eisenhower. Whether it's the missiles in Turkey or England or Mongoose or Bay of Pigs or even, planning to fire missiles right away. It's Eisenhower, among others, are right there. And so anyway, this is the point I'm trying to get to. They found out later that a number of missiles were armed by day two. So what that means is, as the military was getting their ships in lined up and or their missiles ready and all this sort of stuff, and we're talking about we need to fire the missiles and then invade. If anything that they suggested had gone, taken the next step, we wouldn't be here today. Because all those suggestions came after day two. I mean, they were talking about we should invade on day one, but they weren't ready to do that because a lot of preparation is required before they engage in some kind of serious military action. So by the time they could have done that, had they done it, you know, they were not only were the many missiles armed and they had the numbers way off. Kennedy would ask them, well, suppose you kill some Russian troops. Then what? What do you think Khrushchev is going to do? Well, they don't have an answer. They're not even thinking along those lines. Turns out that the American intelligence was saying that there were 10,000 Russian troops operating all the missiles and so on, and all the you know artillery, all kinds. They had it. They were really, you know, loaded. There were 40,000. The actual number was 40,000. So they, you know, it had been a nightmare had there any conflict resulted. It would have gone the whole distance. There's just too much involved. People, they had tactical weapons. They had different missiles and 40,000 troops. And John McCone, head of the CIA, I'll tie this back in with Senator Keating saying since September 1st, and this takes place first. The first information that eventually finds its way to Kennedy. Kennedy first learned about it on October 15th. John and Keating was saying, no, there's missiles in Cuba since September 1st. John McCone was the other person who also went around saying there were missiles in Cuba, the head of the CIA. But when people asked him, well, what is your source? He said, oh, just a hunch. Oh, yeah, just a hunch. Here's the head of the CIA accurately reporting what would have to be gotten from photographic intelligence. But it's just a hunch. Hint, hint. That's a lot of it's a good story. And you know, people, you hear people saying all the time, oh, it's Kennedy's fault. He got us, he invaded Cuba, and he was behind Mongoose. Robert Kennedy certainly was. And it's his fault anyway. And then you get people like Jeffrey Sachs or even Martin Sherwin saying, oh, it really, really showed his statesmanship, and his leadership, his commitment to peace, how he maneuvered around the military. So, you know, pretty good.
Yeah, and you have some quotes here from Douglas Dillon and General Taylor. Even, you know, everyone knows about LeMay, Curtis LeMay. I mean, they're just saying we've got to act now. And I kind of find funny the survival of the free world is at stake. I mean, the demise of the free world was at stake, you know.
Well, I know when the truth comes out, right? Well, what I did in that section was, you know, the first part of the book is he spent some time on the history of the development of nuclear weapons and close calls and then a little bit about how it's used as one of his big points is how outside of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nuclear missiles haven't been used in combat, but they've been the go-to diplomatic weapon. So if you have missiles, you can always threaten to use them, and that sets the stage for a power. And power, people with a great deal of power engaging in diplomacy. So he talks a little bit about that. But the bulk of the book covers those 13 days. So you have many, many quotes like the ones that I listed. I didn't want to get into just regurgitating that story, but I wanted to put in maybe a half dozen quotes from the military people to give the reader an idea of what Kennedy was up against. And he said in more than one way during that whole place, I'd rather be red than dead. And it says, and I, what are you saying about his family? So I'd rather have them red than dead.
Which was like the Curtis LeMay quote, what, you know, better dead than red.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's like he's really putting himself out there. And what was it? What was he? There was one other one, too, that was funny about that. That's another thing that, you know, different critics of the of Kennedy will say that the whole 13 days was not necessary, because they could have just, rather than blow up the world, it would make more sense just to concede to Khrushchev, and, you know, so there would be absolutely no chance of any conflict. Well, that's kind of interesting, because Kennedy and McNamara both thought that putting weapons in Cuba didn't really alter the balance of power. That there, you know, there are the U.S. had weapons in Turkey and Britain. I don't know if the Cubans had missiles on submarines, or that they had nuclear torpedoes, but I don't know if they had surface to surface missiles or not. But anyway, that's what they thought. So then the question is, well, those critics are right, because you almost risk nuclear war without just conceding. On the other hand, I was thinking about that during this, you know, reading the book, was if Kennedy had said something, when he went on TV and said, you know, we've discovered missiles and this is what we're doing at the moment. So if he says, actually, it doesn't alter the balance of power, and I think we should concede to the Soviets, he would have been, he would have to had resigned. Then the military would have taken over and blown everything up. So it's only by virtue of the fact that he and Stevenson chose this peaceful option, the diplomatic option, whether or not he thought there was a, you know, a massive risk to the United States or not. It's only because they were there that that we didn't get blown up, because the other people would have been. Eisenhower would have jumped in there. You know, all these political figures. He's in Dillon, Treasury Secretary. He's pulling his arrow. He wants to attack. That chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Taylor. He wants to immediately go in there and bomb. The only difference, David, some of them was, we got to go in there right away and bomb. And then other ones would say, well, we should invade. Well, maybe we should bomb first and then invade. Well, if we invaded, what planes we would use? Where would they come from? So all that planning and figuring out things about if we're going to have a blockade, that gave Kennedy enough time to get into like day 13. But that was it. In fact, the very final thing, and I've read where Chomsky has really belittled Kennedy when Kennedy agreed to remove the missiles in Turkey. Then saying about the missiles in Great Britain that Eisenhower had put in there. And they were pretty worthless anyway, because the Polaris superseded them. But he kept that secret. He didn't tell anybody about that. And that, and Chomsky says, oh, that's very macho. And the reality is, this is day 13. And Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy and a few of the others were now frantic, trying to not just get, not only to get Khrushchev to agree on what they were thinking about, was to just to communicate with them in time with you know, various people that Robert Kennedy was meeting with. And so and they kept it secret from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Chiefs of Staff. That's what they were keeping a secret from. In fact, it wasn't ever really disclosed fully until it was one of these anniversaries. Let's see, it was 62, 34 years later, in 1996, there was a meeting of all the principals, you know, thinking, you know, going back over, you know, what happened during those 13 days. It was at that time, first time ever, that Sorensen said, yes, we agreed with Khrushchev in order to end the crisis, that we would take out those missiles. And also pledged not to invade Cuba. So that's another dart in the ass for the military, because not only do they don't get the chance to invade, but Kennedy's saying, hey, well, you're never going to invade, because I've just promised we're not invading. We're taking those missiles out, but he never told them that. So it's that kind of thing. When you read that book, what you become aware of, it's not so easy to say, oh, he should have talked about the missiles, or he should have done this, or he was responsible for the buildup, or whatever. It's far more complex. There's so many more people involved.
Yeah, I've got your article open in front of me, and the one guy you were talking about was Admiral George Anderson, Chief of Naval Operations. He was saying, you know, this is a lame response, you know, from the president who ducked military intervention other places, you know.
Yeah.
But he was furious. And then all these other generals, Taylor and Wheeler, and of course Curtis LeMay, who's almost just famous for that.
Yeah.
Right. You see what he's up against, right?
You know, on one level I can understand that, like, their position, the military position, these chiefs would say, look, we've been involved in war and trained for war for 22 or three decades in our lifetime, and then you want to turn this over to Lieutenant Kennedy, you know, we're the experts in this. See, that's where Eisenhower doesn't incur the wrath of anybody, because he's the great general. So he's president, but he also can make military decisions. And LeMay thought he was great and all this sort of thing. So poor John Kennedy, you know, 47 years old, or however he was there, you know, they hated him. It just comes right, just drips right off the pages. They couldn't stand it.
Well, as you mentioned in another quote, they said there was the smell of a coup. You know, I'm not saying that there was a coup was there, but everybody had that smell, you know.
Yeah.
And that's another anecdote I have about when I was talking to Colonel Fletcher Prouty, and when he went to the South Pole, Antarctica, and he knew what was going on there. And then when he came back, he said in the Pentagon, wings had opened up that, you know, they were planning this Vietnam thing is gung-ho, it's on now, everything's on. And so if they got rid of Kennedy, all the things they wanted to do, they just got their green light. So I said to him, you know, there's smart people there working in the CIA and intelligence and the Department of Defense. Like, did they know that, you know, this Lee Oswald thing is just a patsy, as he said, and all that, right? I mean, they had to know the real opposition came from the real movers and shakers in America. And, you know, I asked him once or twice, and he was kind of kept talking about something else. And then I said, come on, Fletch, did they know? And he said, they all knew, you know, like, yeah, they all knew what happened. Mm. That finally they said, that guy's got to go. And they pulled the carpet out from him.
I think that's, you know, like, you and the others do all that work because it's presented in the media as though it's a great mystery, you know. Well, now there's two shooters, one more than Oswald. Jeez, that's a great revelation.
Yeah. And can you imagine, of all people, you know, Donald Trump is going to be releasing these files. Every other president, even Bush, kind of said, I think every American should watch the movie JFK because it's of interest, but, you know, he can't comment on it. But, I mean, it's like that. I mean, how many other things have happened, like Bobby Kennedy, you know, 9/11, the Oklahoma bombing, and I could just go on and on. How many of these things are big business, you know, rears its head and they have a meeting like in the movie Nixon where they're at a gentleman's club and they all talk and they say, that guy's got to go.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Dulles, you got a team of people. And, of course, you know, the fact that Alan Dulles is hired to be on the Warren Commission.
Well, you know, as far as these other events, I'm hoping that if Trump does really do what he says he's going to do, and they're not, you know, blacked out and so forth, and maybe they can actually say there was a conspiracy. I don't think there's going to be smoking guns or anything. But that should then, people should then say, well, let's open the books on 9/11, you know, and start going down the list of all these, even Pearl Harbor for that matter, you know.
Yeah, Doug Horne wrote a good book about that, and many, if you look into it, I mean, you have to look for these things. They're never on the news or in mainstream. But people, you know, there was an 8-point plan to provoke Japan into attacking them.
Yeah,
they had broken the code, and they were studying a couple of the spies in Honolulu, and they knew. And then, you know, they pulled the aircraft carriers and the important things out, and then they said, oh, my God, we just got hit, punched in the nose. Day of infamy.
Right. Well, that's history. It's just interesting how, like in my own case, you know, I had a teaching assignment at, it was just a year long, at UC Santa Cruz. And this was 1988. And it was my teaching assignment was to do some classes around the founding period. You know, and that wasn't anything that I had spent a lot of time looking at. So I had to do research as I'm teaching the class. And every time I would find decent information, I'd say to myself, I never knew that. You know, I never knew George Washington, like it was called, something like a town killer. The Indians called him a town killer because he'd go in there and kill everybody in the town. All kinds of things. Basically, that the founders were very anti-democratic. They feared democracy. They feared the limited democracy that existed under the Articles of Confederation, so they had to redo the whole thing. But anyway, the point being is that I wrote this book on what I found, because it was the bicentennial of the signing of the Constitution, ratification of the Constitution. And so I was able to get this book published. So then in subsequent interviews, this one professor pulled me over and says, you realize, of course, you're never going to get a job with that book out there. And I said, I didn't say anything. I said to myself, oh, that guy's an idiot. Oh, what do you mean? That's a nice book. I'm very proud of my book. He was finally figured out, you know, I'd go to interviews, nothing happened. I finally figured out, you know, I think he's right. I think the book alone is enough, where no one wants me to tamper with the young people, the mind of the young people at their university. So it's like that everywhere. Everybody's got to toe the line. All these different things we hear about 9/11 or, you know, Malcolm X or King or any of these kind of things. People, the media, they, like you said, they probably know or suspect, but they just can't turn that corner and really let it, you know, talk about it openly, or else they'll get the heave-ho.
And now we're finding out just how much money USAID has been spending to control the media.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. And some people are all pissed off at Trump and Elon Musk, but other people are saying, I knew it all along, and now we have proof. And it's just unbelievable that you wonder if, you know, how many shows are just going to keep waving that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was Lee Oswald, and they refuse to, derelict right on their duty of doing any kind of investigation. And that's what makes, you know, when you read a book like this and even your article on the book and that, it says, look, here's something about what really happened. Now, you can find it uncomfortable or not, but this is what happened.
Yeah, it's just, well, that's why, you know, I was going to say the one part that's missing in that book is something about how all those people who were denied the opportunity to go in and get rid of Castro and his government, killed Kennedy afterwards. That should be the next chapter, the last chapter. But he doesn't, of course, that's more like Douglas's book, because he's always weaving the story and the assassination together. But he hints at it. He's always winking a little bit and kind of letting the reader know who's Kennedy's enemies were and were becoming. So it's a very, it's, you know, if anybody who is crossed over to where it's, you know, they've rejected the Warren Commission explanation, this kind of book, you know, he winks enough to let you know that it's all related.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm going to have to look at some of those interviews of the author and Jeffrey Sachs that you mentioned.
Yeah,
just to start with, I haven't got the book, so that's another thing. But yeah, I mean, lately they've been pulling out Gerald Posner and others to say, you know, these new files that are coming out, they're just going to reinforce that Lee Oswald did it alone, and you know, so that's why I'm so interested in this real articles and real books and yeah, you know, information.
Yeah.
Just about what really happened, regardless if you find it uncomfortable.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then, of course, I think it ends up, you wrap up with saying, you know, we knew what happened after that, Vietnam, you know, and Vietnam was on full bore after that. And you can make the case that then Johnson recognized that when he realized, God, he's in a no-win situation, and now he's in a similar situation to Kennedy. He said, they'll kill me if I pull out of Vietnam, just like they pulled, you know, Kennedy pulled out of a Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs. And so he just said, I'm going to resign.
You know, that's one, you mentioned LBJ. That's one thing that's also interesting about the book. LBJ doesn't appear in the book at all, even though he's a member of the XCOM committee and attends some of the meetings. I don't know how many, because he's never mentioned. I did hear Sorensen say, years ago, saying when people asked him about what was Johnson's view, what did Johnson have to say during the XCOM sessions? He said, well, what we do in Texas is that when a rattler comes sidewinding by, we chop its head off. Oh, great diplomat.
Yeah, well, that's just studying real history, and that's what happens. Your article is up at Kennedy's and King, and you were talking about the work of Martin Sherwin, worked on American Prometheus, which was the basis for the book, or the movie even, Oppenheimer, but Gambling with Armageddon, which is the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you just found it a riveting read. You couldn't put it down, and you know, few books are like that these days, so.
Yeah, especially, you know, a heavy book like that.
Okay, well, very good. I've enjoyed talking to you. Before we wrap up then, is there anything you want to get to that we didn't bring up?
No, I'm a painter now. I make my living painting in Italy. And so I have no websites to go to except my own, you know, as far as painting is concerned. So no, nothing as far as the community is, I do that would be of any interest.
Okay, fine. Yeah, you just have a section which is concluding thoughts too, which I thought was of interest, and I guess we've kind of gone over it. And what we should do is urge people to go to Kennedy's and King and read your article.
All right, well, thank you very much, Lynn. I enjoyed it, and I look forward to more of your programming.
Okay, thank you, and keep in touch via email now that we've made contact, and if there's anything of news, just give me a call there.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night.